From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Did James Comey set the record straight? Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. In more than 2 hours of testimony before a Senate committee today, former FBI Director James Comey came close to calling the president who fired him a liar. The White House denied the claim and called it insulting, but Republican senators did not challenge Comey's truthfulness. Many questions remain. Did the president try to obstruct a federal investigation? What was the role of Attorney General Jeff Sessions? What impact will Comey's dramatic appearance have on the probe of Russia's ongoing interference with U.S. elections? And how to stop it? Later on today's Talking Point, we'll go behind the velvet rope for a look at five-star health care for the richest Americans. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, we're only back with To the Point. Some Americans are paying up to $80,000 a year to get immediate attention from doctors, including specialists, as well as hospital rooms that cost more than New York's high-priced hotels. Health care for the very rich. That's later on in our program. First, today's Senate committee testimony by James Comey, the former FBI director fired by President Trump. Comey described an extraordinary meeting just before Trump was inaugurated that Comey felt needed careful documentation.
Circumstances. First, I was alone with the president of the United States, or the president-elect, soon to be president. The subject matter, I was talking about matters that touch on the FBI's core responsibility and that relate to the president, president-elect, personally. And then the nature of the person. I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting, and so I thought it really important to document.
Here's White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
No, I can definitively say the president's not a liar. And I think it's frankly insulting that that question would be asked.
Josh Meyer is investigative reporter for Politico. Good to have you back on our program.
Great to be here, Warren.
Comey said at another point that he thought that the president and others in the White House had lied about the condition of the FBI when he, Comey, was fired. What else came out of this hearing today and set the scene for us? It was a pretty dramatic event.
Dramatic indeed. I mean, I've been doing this for a long time. I mean, I was there during the 9/11 commission hearings when Dick Clark said, the government let you down, and I'm sorry, and, we missed the signs for 9/11, for some other memorable moments, too. But I don't think anything really compares to this. I mean, it was really an extraordinary hearing. To me, one thing that I was really struck by was that, Comey sat down, resolutely stared straight ahead, and then when it was his time to talk, he just, spoke extemporaneously. He just, stone cold, no notes, just, talked to the lawmakers and just, spoke off the top of his head. But he came out swinging. I mean, he was pretty forceful in what he was saying. I don't think that there were any sort of shocking bombshells that came out of this, but it raised a lot more questions. I think it's really now, almost imperative that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, looks into the obstruction of justice charges. I don't think that there's any way he can't do that now. And also to get the tapes. I mean, I think for me, one of the big takeaways was Comey's "Lordy, I really hope there are tapes" comment, because I think we all do.
Well, as we heard just now, he set himself opposite to the president of the United States on a very important issue, and that is whether the well, he talked about the FBI's core responsibility in that soundbite, but what he really wanted to do was make the point that the president appeared to be asking him to ease up on an investigation of the former national security advisor, Mr. Flynn. And that's really where he came close to suggesting that the president had obstructed justice. At least he got a lot of questions about that, which he said he couldn't answer.
Right. I mean, when you have the White House spokesman even having to say, "I can definitively say that the president is not a liar," that's not good optics for you, I think. So, we were all waiting to see if Trump would start tweeting in response to this. You know, the sort of joke in the newsroom was whether they had sort of wrestled away from or wrested away from the president, you know, his electronic devices so that he couldn't tweet. But, you know, this was just some very serious allegations by, you know, the former FBI director about what transpired in those meetings, in those phone calls. Now we know that there were a total of 9 of them. You know, as I wrote in a lengthy story a few weeks back, I mean, obstruction of justice requires intent. But, you know, there, it's hard to see that at least a possible case couldn't be made that that's what he was doing, you know, even if you just take Trump's own admissions and base it on that.
We already have the president, of course, telling Lester Holt of NBC that he did fire Comey because of the Russian investigation. And he said the same thing to the two Russian diplomats who were in his office. But how did the Republicans and Democrats treat Comey, given the extraordinary nature of this situation?
You know, Warren, I thought they did a pretty good job. Some better than others. I mean, this was not one of those farcical hearings from the House Intel Committee where, you know, all of the Republicans wanted to focus on was, you know, leaks and things like that. I mean, they fastidiously didn't even address any of the underlying issues. I mean, I can understand why you'd want to go after, you know, who leaked what and when, but you also should at least pretend to care about the fact that the United States was, you know, attacked digitally by Russia in terms of swinging the election. So the senators today, I think, did a better job. I think even the Republicans were trying to get to the bottom of what happened. I think the Democrats were you know, came out swinging much more aggressively. One of the things that I thought was new today was the focus on Attorney General Jeff Sessions and even Attorney General Loretta Lynch and the role of the Attorney General in all of this in terms of getting involved in the politics and sticking up and standing up for the Justice Department. I mean, the Justice Department is supposed to conduct investigations without regard for politics, and the Attorney General is supposed to shield them from that. And in both cases, it seems like neither of them did that. But, you know, the Obama's Attorney General and Trump's as well.
Loretta Lynch, the Obama Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, of course, the Attorney General now for Donald Trump. We'll hear more about them as we go forward and hear more about this hearing and talk to more people about what took place. And in a moment, we'll be hearing from the ranking member of the committee you just referred to, the House Intelligence Committee, and hear what Adam Schiff of California has to say about all of this. We'll be back and continue this conversation. Once again, this is To the Point from Public Radio International.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. Once again, James Comey told the Senate committee today that he'd had at least nine separate encounters with the President of the United States, some on the phone, some in the office. And he just, in answer to a question from New Mexico Senator Martin Heinrich, Comey goes into one of the meetings he had with the president where the president shooed everybody out and just he and the president were left alone. Senator asked him very pointedly why Americans should believe his account of that meeting rather than the chief executive.
You got to take it all together, and I've tried to be open and fair and transparent and accurate. A really significant fact to me is, so why did he kick everybody out of the Oval Office? Why would you kick the Attorney General, the President, the Chief of Staff out to talk to me if it was about something else? And so that to me, as an investigator, is a very significant fact.
Just have to say, I think he meant the Vice President, Mr. Pence, rather than the President. Adam Schiff is with us again, ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. Good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Warren.
What do you think about this hearing? You must have watched it with great interest and great care.
I certainly did. And, you know, I guess what I found shocking from the very beginning was the director of the FBI, former director Comey, testifying that he immediately felt the need after the first meeting with the president to memorialize these meetings in writing because he was worried that the president of the United States may misrepresent or lie about what happened. And that's kind of an initial shock when the hearing begins. But then to be told in testimony that the President of the United States directed him to drop a criminal case that he wanted the director to help remove a cloud over him. And, you know, failing to do either, he's ultimately fired. It's hard to really appreciate just how stunning that truly is.
The attorney for Donald Trump, Mark Kasowitz, has released a statement saying the president never in the form of substance directed Comey to stop the investigation. And this goes to the fact which Republicans and Democrats brought out, which was that the president didn't directly say, cut this out, will you? He said, I hope that you will go easy, or words to that effect, on Michael Flynn.
Well, yes, certainly those are the words that Director Comey testified the president used. But I don't think that excuses the president or negates what the director said. The director took that as a directive. You're going to drop this case. This is what I want. And, of course, I think everyone can appreciate that although he may have used the word hope, the signal he was sending was, this is what I want done. And the fact that the director didn't do it doesn't exonerate the president in any way. Look, you know, having prosecuted cases for 6 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office, some involving corruption, people often don't talk in direct terms. Their actions and other things they do tell exactly what their intent is. And here I think Director Comey pointed quite correctly to the fact that the president is clearing the room. To me, that's real consciousness that what the president is about to do is improper. Not just that the subject matter is going to be what the director says and not what the president has subsequently claimed, but rather consciousness on the president's part that what he's about to ask or demand is improper. And so I think that's pretty compelling. Now,
well, does that go to the question of intent that Josh Meyer raised earlier, which would be necessary if you were going to charge somebody with obstruction of justice?
It does go to intent. And, one of the other things that we're going to need to get to the bottom of is we cannot accept the non-answers of Director Coates and Director Rogers, and indeed we'll need Director Pompeo also to testify to this. And that is, did they get asked by the president to weigh in with Director Comey to drop the Flynn matter? That would obviously corroborate the testimony of Director Comey, but it would show that the president is going to concerted effort, that it is more than just the phrasing of a abstract hope. So these are, I think, important steps that we're going to need to take. But it's one thing to say what is the intent that you would need for a normal prosecution. This, of course, is not a normal prosecution, and it's hard for me to imagine that Bob Mueller, no matter how strong the evidence may be, is going to expect to bring the President of the United States into a criminal courthouse and make a case before 12 jurors. I think what he's likely to conclude is this needs to be referred back to the Congress, because ultimately it's a decision the Congress ought to make, not the special counsel.
Bob Mueller, of course, again, the special counsel, also a former director of the FBI and somebody that Mr. Comey spoke very highly of and who he reassured the senators would, he thought, do a great job. What's next for your committee?
We are bringing in witnesses that are percipient witnesses to some of the events that we're investigating. We have, in the process of scheduling a hearing with former Secretary Jay Johnson. Secretary Johnson was one of the three agency heads who signed that October attribution of responsibility for the first time, acknowledging that Russia was behind the hack, that it was orchestrated at the top of the Kremlin. He was also the interface with state elections officials and will be able to testify about the threat the Russians posed to our elections infrastructure. So that'll be our next open hearing. And then, of course, we're going to want to hear, I think, privately from those surrounding Director Comey about whether they can corroborate his account.
All right, Adam Schiff, again, the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, Democrat from California. Always good to talk with us. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Amy Jeffress is a former Justice Department official. She's currently a partner with the law firm Arnold Porter Kay and Scholer in Washington. And you knew Mr. Comey, did you not, when you were working in the Justice Department?
I did. I don't want to say that I know him well personally, but I was in the department for 20 years, including when he was Deputy Attorney General and then later when he came back as FBI Director. So I've seen him in action, and so I know how he operates, and he's a very, very impressive person, as we've seen today at today's hearing.
What did you think about his testimony? He started out with a very impassioned defense of the FBI against what he said were lies by the president and his staff about the FBI being in terrible shape and that people had lost confidence in him.
That clearly made him very angry, the comments that the FBI had been poorly led and it was in chaos. And I think that that, at least in part, prompted his desire to appear today. He wanted to wanted to say that the FBI is doing a great job and remains independent and will not be deterred from doing what the FBI needs to do to complete this investigation. And the other point that I thought he was very, very passionate about was the importance of the investigation, and spoke very passionately about how the Russians have absolutely interfered with our election, that it came from the top of their government and was a hostile act. And, you know, he said that it was not a close call. It was a very, very serious matter. And I thought that is a very, very good point. And some of the senators seem to say as well that they think this is a very serious matter that has to be investigated thoroughly.
Okay. Let me just run down a couple of more things that went on in the hearing today. And we'll hear from Mr. Comey how he responded about a basic question that was asked to him by several people. And that was, if this situation was so important with President Trump saying the kinds of things that he did and risking possibility of obstructing justice, why didn't he warn somebody about that? Why didn't he get somebody to get word to the president, and particularly if he thought that the president was in fact telling him to change the investigation or to let up on the investigation and essentially obstruct justice? Here's his answer to a question by Senator James Risch.
I took it as a direction.
Right.
I mean, this is the President of the United States with me alone saying, I hope this. I took it as this is what he wants me to do. Now, I didn't obey that, but that's the way I took it.
Then California Senator Dianne Feinstein asked him a very similar question.
Why didn't you stop and say, Mr. President, this is wrong. I cannot discuss this with you.
It's a great question. Maybe if I were stronger, I would have. I was so stunned by the conversation that I just took it in. And the only thing I could think to say, because I was playing in my mind, because I was going to remember every word he said, I was playing in my mind, what should my response be? And that's why I very carefully chose the words. And look, I've seen the tweet about tapes. Lordy, I hope there are tapes.
And here is Senator Rubio from Florida, Marco Rubio, of course, asking again about the appropriateness of that Oval Office meeting.
Did you say anything to the president about that is not an appropriate request? Or did you tell the White House counsel that is not an appropriate request? Someone needs to go tell the president that he can't do these things?
I didn't, no.
Okay. Why?
I don't know. I think, as I said earlier, I think the circumstances were such that I was a bit stunned and didn't have the presence of mind.
Francis Buckley is foundation professor at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I thought what we saw this morning was just an extraordinary drama and one full of the fog of war. I mean, one thing I got out of this is the difference between seeing a screenplay, the words on the page, and seeing it acted. Because what was missing from the transcripts, the notes taken by Comey, was the background, the visual cues, everything that was going on. And it sounded like really the most painful of dinners, the most painful of encounters. I mean, if you walk into a meeting and you say to yourself, I don't trust this guy, and I have to take notes, you're doing something to communicate, necessarily communicating an absence of trust. And, you know, and as for the fog of war issue, you can tell, it's like Rashomon. You can tell very different stories about what happened, consistent with the integrity of all of the players. You know, I look at it, and what I don't see is obstruction of justice.
Why not?
Because I see in the end a demand for honest loyalty, which is basically what you would have expected of a member of the legal team of an administration. Honest loyalty is not the same thing as honest disloyalty. Honest disloyalty is when you rush from a room and you talk to the press right away, or you reveal notes through one of your friends who happens to be in Columbia Law School. Honest loyalty means that you're loyal both to the law and you also recognize that in a pinch, you're also a member of the administration, and without betraying your calling to the law, yet you are also a member of a legal team as part of the government.
You made that reference to Columbia Law School, and a friend at Columbia Law School, Mr. Comey, said today this is one of the sort of blockbuster admissions that came, that he did, in fact, show his notes to his friend at Columbia Law School, the notes he took on those conversations with the president.
I guess I wouldn't blame him for that. You know what I would blame him for? It really was entirely unnecessary to, in his notes released yesterday, start talking about all those salacious rumors, which were false, involving the president. But you know, that served to get it out there, and this was the action of a consummate political player. So there are a lot of things that were troubling about what happened from the point of view of me, a Trump supporter, and one of them was kicking Jeff Sessions out of the room. But, you know, even then, looking at all of this, I don't see the mens rea, in part and most importantly because nothing happened thereafter. I mean, the investigation went on.
Amy Jeffress, back to you, formerly with the Justice Department. The lawyer for the president, Mark Kasowitz, has said today that Comey made unauthorized disclosures of presidential conversations. Do you think that's true?
No, I don't think that that's true. You know, former officials write books about the conversations that take place during an administration, and some people frown on that, but certainly it's not the first time that someone has spoken publicly about the inner workings of an administration after leaving the administration. So I don't think that it was improper, and especially given how much controversy there was and really how many contradictions there were about what had actually happened in those conversations. He felt the need to set the record straight.
Did you see, contrary to what Professor Buckley says, that there was evidence of some kind of obstruction?
Well, there have been a lot of opinions, and there's a lot of discussion on legal blogs about whether this is obstruction, and certainly some of the facts that came out today about exactly what he just mentioned, Attorney General Sessions being, you know, removed from the conversation so that it could be just the president and Director Comey. That that does add to the evidence there. But I think that reasonable people differ, and I'm not sure that I would say that it is obstruction. But ultimately, I don't think that it's relevant whether it does amount to obstruction as a matter of a criminal offense, because I agree with what Congressman Schiff just told you earlier on the program, that this is ultimately an issue that Congress is going to have to address.
Professor Buckley, quickly, do you think Congress will have to address this in some way? And if so, how?
Well, ultimately, it's, you know, there's a legal question as to whether or not a crime was committed. And I think most people would say, no, a crime has not been committed. But there is a big-time political problem of an improper conversation by the president with Director Comey. And there will be political consequences for that, and one side will ramp it up as much as possible. With they'll try to get impeachment hearings out of it. That, I expect, will go absolutely nowhere. You know, when I looked at all of this, what I saw was just really, really bad vibes in the conversation. That was my read, okay? And if you've ever had the occasion to let an employee go, you know the feeling when things just are not working out. And that's what was happening, I think.
Okay. Francis Buckley, once again, at the Antonin Scalia Law School, George Mason University. We're going to take a very brief break on our talking point later. We'll go behind the velvet rope for a look at five-star health care for the very richest Americans. It's really quite a story. Back in a moment with To the Point on this conversation from PRI. Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about 2.5 hours of extraordinary testimony by a former former head of the FBI fired by the president of the United States, talking about private meetings that he had with the president, quite a number of them, suggesting that the president, in fact, had ordered him to cease an investigation that might be embarrassing to the president or difficult for him to deal with. McKay Coppins is a staff writer for The Atlantic. He's covered the rise of Donald Trump from candidate to president, and his most recent article is entitled What Trump Really Fears. McKay Coppins, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Did the president hear today what he really fears?
I think that this was not a great day for Donald Trump. I actually checked in with one of Trump's former campaign advisors right after the hearing ended and said, you know, overall, was this a good day, a bad day, a wash for the president? The advisor said to me that yesterday when Comey's opening statement was published on the Senate Intelligence Committee's website, a lot of Trump's supporters, both publicly and privately, people close to him in his orbit, were celebrating because they felt like while the opening statement was certainly not flattering, it didn't necessarily have any kind of smoking gun. It didn't provide any kind of new information beyond Comey kind of adding details to what we've already seen reported. And so basically the Trump orbit was celebrating yesterday. But this former campaign advisor told me that today people are not so happy in Trump's orbit, that they feel like this was not a very, you know, the testimony could be damaging, certainly politically, possibly legally, that this issue is not going to go away. And I think that they're particularly upset that the Republicans on the committee, for the most part, did not seem to challenge Comey's testimony. I thought that that was pretty fascinating, that Republican senators, even those who clearly were trying to kind of defend the president, the way they were doing it was saying, well, in a different, maybe you took this to mean something that the president didn't intend, or maybe in this conversation the context is different than what you thought. But ultimately, no one was challenging the facts of what former FBI Director Comey was saying. That is not what's happening now. Just recently, in the wake of this hearing, we saw that the president's personal attorney went out and said that at least one of those exchanges that Comey recited was not true. The one where Comey says that Trump asked for his loyalty. Trump's personal attorney is representing him in this matter, said that that is factually untrue. So as has often been the case, I think you see Trump being much more combative, much more belligerent than the rest of the people in his party are willing to be. And the question going forward is whether Republicans on Capitol Hill will continue to kind of defend him to get out in front of him, or whether they're going to let him kind of do this on his own. That's a question that remains to be seen.
We heard Mr. Comey say, Lordy, I hope there are tapes that would deal with the issue of whether he asked for loyalty or not, presumably, if there were. One thing he did say, too, is that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, does have his carefully recorded notes on these conversations. Does that suggest that the president himself now is under investigation?
Well, that is the speculation I can tell you among a lot of the Republicans I'm talking to. That might end up being one of the most consequential revelations to come out of this hearing, which is that, you know, Comey said that he was not that the president was not personally under investigation when he himself was leading the FBI. But in the wake of the of Comey's firing, it appears at least possible that the reason Mueller and the special prosecutor's team has those memos is that they're looking into whether there was obstruction of justice. Now, I'm not a lawyer. A lot of the conversation you've had so far is about whether this would actually qualify as obstruction of justice. It sounds like there's a good faith debate to be had among legal experts. But what I do know is that one of the things, and you mentioned the piece that I wrote earlier this week, one of the things that is a growing concern in the Trump White House is where Mueller's investigation could take them. So obviously we've heard a lot about Russia, we've heard a lot about the firing of Comey, but we also know that Trump has long surrounded himself with kind of a motley crew of lieutenants and loyalists who tend to emulate Trump and adopt Trump's style and often compete ferociously to impress him. And one of the things that I've heard from people close to the president is they're increasingly worried about what skeletons may emerge as the investigators are kind of poking around Trump's various campaign and business employees. They're worried about what lines may have been crossed, what kind of unsavory things might have been done in a misguided effort to impress the boss.
Another person involved in all of this, who I don't think falls into the category that you just described, is the Attorney General of the United States, former Senator Jeff Sessions. And his situation came up, and he, of course, was asked to leave when the president spoke to the FBI director, according to the FBI director, former FBI director. His subject came up at the hearing today. Ron Wyden, senator from Oregon, Democrat, said he wanted to know why there wasn't more talk about that.
He was very close to and inevitably going to recuse himself for a variety of reasons. We also were aware of facts that I can't discuss in an open setting that would make his continued engagement in a Russia-related investigation problematic. And so we were convinced, and in fact, I think we'd already heard that the career people were recommending that he recuse himself, that he was not going to be in contact with Russia-related matters much longer.
Once again, the question was, why didn't the former attorney, former FBI director, bring these issues up with the then Attorney General? Josh Meyer, a senior investigative reporter for Politico, you're the one who originally brought up the issue of Attorney General Sessions and his involvement in all of this. What do you make of it?
You know, I think it raises a lot of very serious questions, Warren. I mean, and you could see that they went after him pretty hard on that. I mean, Kamala Harris, in particular, a former prosecutor and state attorney general, was asking a lot of questions about what Attorney General Sessions was doing, what he might have known at the time, whether it was proper for him to do that. And again, it gets back to the issue of, you know, the attorney general is a political appointee, but they are there as a sort of, firewall to protect the Justice Department from political interference. I mean, I remember I was at Attorney General Eric Holder's confirmation hearings, and they, you know, asked him to sort of essentially swear an oath to protect that. Sessions himself, when he was a senator, you might remember, you know, that he asked Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates whether she was aware of the fact that she had the responsibility to say no to the president if he asks for something that's improper. The Senate and the House take that very seriously. I mean, Senator Patrick Leahy, I remember, when Sally Yates' firing came up, he said that that by firing her, Trump placed the independence of the Justice Department at stake, and that the attorney general is the people's attorney, not the president's attorney. So I think that that's something that's going to be coming up more and more here. One thing that I wanted to sort of just briefly add, when we're talking about the obstruction of justice, I'm not a lawyer either, but having done a lot of reporting on this, it's all part of a context. I mean, if there was one meeting or one utterance from the president about, laying off, Mike Flynn, that's one thing. But I think that they'll be looking at this in a broader context and looking at his activities in the 9 conversations with Comey, but also in his activities with, the DNI director, with the CIA director, with the FBI, other people. And so you have a pattern of activity where the president is basically leaning on all these other people, as well as Comey, to intervene in the Russia investigation, to make public pronouncements that aren't true about, how they're not finding anything. So I think that there's a lot there that they're going to be looking at to look at an obstruction case that goes well beyond just the meetings with Comey.
So far, we don't have direct testimony about that. The individuals you named refused to talk about it yesterday when they testified before this same committee. I want to go back to Amy Jeffress once again, formerly with the Justice Department, about the question of whether Mr. Comey ought to have told the attorney general about all of this. What about just assuming that he was going to recuse himself? Is that a sufficient explanation? Shouldn't he have reported to the highest official in the Justice Department what he knew and what was going on?
No. In fact, you could certainly say that if Director Comey knew that there was a basis for requiring Attorney General Sessions to recuse himself, it would have been improper for him to have told him something that that he knew was a matter that he was about to be recused from. So I thought that answer I was completely acceptable.
Frances Buckley, a professor again at the Antonin Scalia Law School, a supporter of President Trump. What do you think about the involvement of the attorney general in all of this? And should he, Jeff Sessions, have asked Comey what went on when the president told him to leave the room?
Well, I think you can tell a couple of stories that are consistent with
Sessions not being in the room. I'm sorry, however, that he wasn't in the room. Up to now, mostly what we've heard is you know, innuendo, suggestions, speculations. And as a Trump supporter, I guess my response would be, bring it on. I'm really happy that this thing is being investigated, that it's been investigated by a guy like Mueller. And to the extent that there's something there, I expect we'll find out about it. And until then, I think the best thing we can do is wait and see.
Okay, Coppins, what do you expect to hear next? We heard earlier from Adam Schiff that they're going to look on the House side, the House Intelligence Committee, that they're going to be looking into more about Russia and the hacking of the election. But the Mueller investigation and the Senate committee appear to be very, very interested in what went on between the Attorney General and the President and those kinds of things. What do you expect to see next? What are you going to be covering?
Well, it's a good question. It's not entirely clear. I know that there are basically two tracks on which this is proceeding. There's the criminal track where the Mueller and his team are investigating, and I have to say it will probably be a while before they reach any kind of conclusions that they'll share publicly. One of the things that I think is going to frustrate Democrats and Trump opponents is that if this moves fully or at least mostly into the criminal sphere where the special counsel is really leading out on this investigation, it's going to be an agonizingly long process because that's how our criminal justice system works. And you know, I think there's a case that it should work. If Democrats, and I think they do, if they want to keep this alive, keep this on the front pages of newspapers, keep this as, you know, a dominant issue in Washington and in America, they're going to have to find more to investigate. They're going to have to have more hearings, and they can go one of two directions. They can talk. They can investigate more on possible obstruction. They can look more at, you know, the firing of the FBI director, of his relationship with the Attorney General, what conversations may have been had there, or they can look at what is at the core of this whole issue, which I think we are at risk of losing sight of, which is that a foreign adversary tried to interfere with our presidential elections to get a certain outcome, and that's what I hope that we see more of from Congress.
Former FBI Director Comey twice went on at some length about that. This is the one in response to Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. Why is this such a big deal?
Well, I mean, it's a big deal because for the obvious reasons, right? That right now this is it. You can't help but see this through a partisan lens because it was clear that Russia was trying to help Trump. Now, whether there was collusion or not, we don't know, but we know what the aim was here. It was to help Trump or to at least harm Clinton before she became president. But you know, as one of the senators said today, Vladimir Putin is not a Republican or a Democrat. He's an opportunist. And, you know, going into 2018, going into looking to the next presidential election in 2020 and beyond, Russia's probably not going to stop these attempts. If anything, they're going to get more sophisticated. They've seen how successful they were this time around. They're going to continue to do it. So we need to figure out as a country, the intelligence community needs to figure out how to prevent these sorts of attacks. And I think as a country, as voters and as citizens, we need to figure out how to be able to participate in our democratic process without letting foreign adversaries shape the way that we're thinking or the way that we're interpreting the political events in our own country.
Okay. Once again, when he got the opportunity, the former attorney general emphasized that as well. And I'm just interested in our other guests. Professor Buckley, you think this is a serious matter, I take it. You indicated you were happy to see the investigation go forward.
Yeah, I am happy. Let me add one thing. You know, I'm a dual. I'm also a Canadian. And every so often, American hypocrisy really gets to me. And if you want to start talking about a country that interferes in the elections of other countries, let's start with America.
Okay. Amy Jeffress, back to you at the Justice Department. That point has been made not just by Canadians, but even by some Americans as well. We have indeed interfered with other countries' elections. Is this a chance to come clean about that at the same time that we try to prevent the Russians from doing it?
No, look, I just absolutely agree with Director Comey's comments about how serious this is and how seriously we need to take it. And I take the point about, you know, our activities in the past, but the document that The Intercept published the other day, which reveals that the Russians had actually penetrated the election services in certain states, that I think was an extraordinary bombshell. That is
Amy Jeffries, again, formerly with the Justice Department. Sorry to interrupt you. In the interest of time, Francis Buckley at the Antonin Scalia Law School, McKay Coppins with The Atlantic, Josh Meyer with Politico, and thanks to our earlier guest, Adam Schiff, the congressman from California. In a moment, health care plans for Americans who can pay from $40,000 to $80,000 a year. On To the Point from PRI. Warren Allen here with today's Talking Point. For decades, medical costs have been rising, and patients now have to wait longer than ever for treatments or just consultations. So-called concierge care does ease the various inconveniences if you can afford $500 a month or so. But Nelson Schwartz of the New York Times has gone beyond what he calls the velvet rope to report on doctors and hospitals providing a level of care that's comparable to five-star hotels and restaurants for those who can come up with $5,000 a month. Nelson Schwartz, welcome back.
Great to be here as always.
You've talked to a doctor who says he's an asset manager. What is he talking about?
Well, I think he would sort of say that just as sort of wealthy people have their own personal, you know, very high-end financial advisor who just works for them, kind of like maybe a Goldman Sachs or a family office for, you know, very wealthy family. He serves a small group and manages the entire family's health. So that could be, you know, the grandparents in a nursing home or an assisted living facility. It would be their, you know, middle-aged healthy kids but who want to keep an eye on things and stay healthy. And then their children who need, you know, a pediatrician or adolescent medicine or care at college. And he or she, and they have got, you know, all these specialists in the same practice, kind of can take care of the multi-generational family, and that can cost $40,000 to $80,000 a year, depending on the size of that family.
What about the actual delivery of services, and how different is it from what we've learned to call concierge care?
Well, what I found interesting is when I set out to report this, you know, many of my editors and others like, you know, I know about concierge care, yeah, $400 a month. I said, no, this is totally different. And along with the access, you know, traditional concierge care, you have your doctor's cell phone number and, you know, she can make room for you that same day for an appointment. This is quite different. Basically, the doctor will meet you at the airport if you're about to go on a flight. She'll meet you at your home for what, you know, if need be. And the most interesting part of it to me was when it came to specialists. So let's say, you have a diagnosis for cancer or heart disease or some other very serious condition and you need a specialist. This concierge doctor will find the best person in the country for you and your condition. And let's say they're on the other side of the country. Let's say, you know, you're in L.A. and they're at Sloan Kettering. The doctor will fly with you and be present for the meeting with that specialist and secure you an appointment within a couple of days or a week when other people might have to wait months. And I don't have to say that time is of the essence in these kind of situations. And at the same time, again, this was eye-opening to me as a reporter, you know, the wait for specialists in many cities can be a month or two, whereas a concierge doctor can get you in days.
What does this mean in terms of the number of people a given doctor is able to be available to?
Well, you know, I think that's an issue for the doctors themselves who join these practices. I mean, the concierge doctors typically have no more than 50 families that they're taking care of, whereas many of them told me when they were in even you know, relatively high-end, you know, family medicine or internal medicine practices like at Stanford Hospital, they literally felt like they were on an assembly line, and they could only give each patient 15 minutes. And one of them said he never went to his kid's soccer game or anything else. And, you know, they like it because they have more time. The problem is, yes, there's fewer doctors to go around for everyone else. And I think that becomes more acute, you know, when you're talking about specialists. And the question is, if certain people are jumping the line, does that mean we all have to wait even longer for those specialist appointments?
You talk about a hospital in New York which attempts to create an atmosphere that would remind VIP patients of visiting a luxury boutique or a hotel, not a hospital. So it's not just the doctors, but it's the hospitals too.
Right. I mean, the hospitals, you know, are facing lower reimbursements from the government, you know, from Medicare, Medicaid, from insurance providers. So they're out to sort of, you know, raise as much cash to keep the lights on as they can. And one way to do that is sort of to kind of create high-end settings where patients will pay out of pocket for a bigger room. And, you know, maternity wards are especially popular with that, you know, for that. So, yeah, Lenox Hill is kind of replacing semi-private rooms, you know, with a curtain that you share with another family with private rooms. They can charge a bit extra for a private room or a private suite, like where Beyonce and Jay-Z welcomed a baby into the world, and I think Chelsea Clinton as well. And, you know, these high-end suites might cost, you know, $1,000 or $2,000 extra per night, and that's very valuable revenue for the hospital.
Twice what it costs for a deluxe suite at the Carlisle Hotel,
exactly,
which is down the street, according to
yeah.
the piece that you have published. Well, do any of the doctors feel guilty about this?
You know, that was very interesting to me as well. I think, you know, in other sectors, and I'm writing about this phenomenon, Velvet Rope phenomenon, in many sectors. You know, in other sectors, people say, well, you get what you pay for. This is part of a capitalist economy. You know, when, say, in travel or first class versus coach in an airline, I think doctors and many of the patients understand that medicine is different, and they do grapple with it. I guess they feel, though, given what's going on in the healthcare system, the doctors feel like they have no choice. And you know, I empathize as a parent, in particular, with the patients. I could not afford $40,000 or $50,000 a year for a concierge physician. However, and I am very happy with my regular internist. However, as a parent, you know, I could certainly see the appeal of wanting to jump the line. I just think that's something all of us grapple with, but we've got to figure out the costs of this phenomenon as a society and you know, what impact it has.
You've spent some time talking to Trump voters for
mm-hmm.
the New York Times.
Yep.
How would they look at this kind of thing?
You know, I think this is where it all comes together, and I'm working on a book about this as well. And I have a sort of a website, velvetropeeconomy.com, where I want to gather stories from readers, whatever side of the velvet rope they're on. I think it all comes together in that when a small cohort, and it's not just the 1%, I would say the top 10% of households by income can jump the line in so many spheres, like medicine, but also tourism or, you know, healthcare, what have you, it creates a lot of the divisiveness and the polarization, the anger that we see in this country, and that many of the Trump voters expressed to me in places like Ohio and Indiana, where I spent a lot of time before the election. That's why I see this as more than just one sector or, you know, one issue. And I think, you know, if you are behind the velvet rope, and you don't come into contact with Americans from other classes, that skews your perspective on things on both sides. And I think it creates, you know, a society where people feel like it's each man or each family for themselves.
So it's part of the concentration of wealth in the hands mm-hmm. of so very few people.
Plus, you know, with the economy only growing at 2%, you know, disposable income is really only growing at the top of the income scale. So if you are an airline, a hospital, a doctor, a hotel, you're going to go after the wealthiest customers, not because you're greedy or evil, but simply because that's where the money is. And I think, you know, that's just a huge, again, it makes perfect business sense. You know, we live in a free market society. It's a capitalist society. We you know, that's a given. The question is, in this era of very, very slow growth, when a lot of people are kind of being left behind, how do you balance that with the need for, you know, a cohesive society where everyone feels like they have a, you know, a piece of the action?
You mentioned Beyonce and Chelsea Clinton. One would assume that the Trump family probably also takes advantage of this kind of service.
You know, absolutely. I think the velvet rope doesn't know party lines. And, you know, again, it's quite understandable why anyone would want this. And, you know, part of the hospitals say to me, listen, you know, we're treating many, many patients who are underinsured or not insured. We're treating Medicaid patients by, you know, giving out red blankets to benefactors as they do at Stanford. We're able to treat, you know, more either patients without insurance or even middle class patients like us who have private insurance, but, you know, that they're not getting a full reimbursement for, say, for, you know, advanced neurosurgery or heart surgery. And the other thing that many hospitals are doing, which I didn't get into in this story, but like in L.A., Cedars-Sinai and the Cleveland Clinic are making a huge push to recruit new patients from overseas who pay cash. So, you know, again, like Chinese patients are coming to Cedars-Sinai for heart surgery that's not available in China. They pay cash. And that, you know, that creates, you know, a bit of, you know, breathing room that the hospital will say for their budget. On the other hand, we can say, wait a minute, doesn't that make it harder to get an appointment for people who live here with one of those doctors?
All right. Remind our listeners that you're collecting stories for the book, Both Sides of the Velvet Rope, called VelvetRopeEconomy.com. Nelson Schwartz with The New York Times, as always, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point, a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.